Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, welcome to the Irish Examiner's podcast series on the Civil War. This year, 2022, is of course the centenary of the Civil War, which brought to an end a turbulent near decade of conflict that started with Easter 1916 and culminated with the birth of the state and the dispute over the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921. In this series, we're examining various aspects of the war characterised as pitting brother against brother, and which unfortunately at times descended into, I suppose there's no other word for it, but a form of depravity with various atrocities. Today, we're going to talk about the end of the war and the aftermath, and particularly how people, both those who fought and the ordinary woman and man in the street, were impacted and often traumatised following what was a brutal conflict. Joining me to discuss these issues is Dr. Gavin Foster, who's an Associate Professor in Irish Studies in Concordia University in Canada. Gavin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Gavin, the aftermath, I suppose, early to mid 1923, the war dies down, the Republicans put down their guns. How would you characterise the country at that stage?
Sure, yeah. I think the end of the Civil War is really one of those issues that was kind of understudied, right? There was, if you think about the writing on the Civil War initially, there's a lot of attention to the treaty split, a lot of attention to the early phases of the war. You know, it's a spectacular beginning with the Battle of the Four Courts and all the street fighting in Dublin. But then, of course, the conflict moves out of the towns and city centers, out of the Republic of Munster's towns, and into this kind of insurgency, counterinsurgency dynamic, guerrilla fighting. And so it has a very messy kind of narrative at that point. So they're difficult to kind of establish what's happening where. And as a result, I think there's also a tendency to talk a lot about how wars begin and not so much how they end, which, you know, is rarely clean. And the Irish Civil War is a very good example of this. I mean, we could really debate when the war ended. And, and in a sense, it's also a question of when did the revolution end? And for some activists, the revolution ended, you know, with the Anglo-Irish Truce of 1921. They were out of the fray at that point. They went back to work and their lives, and they were neutral in the Civil War, although they certainly experienced and witnessed some of the horrors of that. But for those activists who, particularly in the Republican side, who threw themselves into the, you know, the fight against the Free State, very often the last months of the Civil War, as we typically view it, you know, early to mid 1923, were some of the bitterest and some of the hardest months. And that's one of the manifold tragedies of the Irish Civil War was just how ugly it got towards the end. And I would argue that it was some of the experiences by the end of the Civil War that really fed the bitterness in the Republican movement. So by the end of, by 1923, what you're seeing is the IRA is no longer, I think, a serious military threat to the Free State Army, which has greater manpower, greater weaponry, a much clearer strategy. And yet the IRA has this incredible ability that they've honed, you know, during the War of Independence to keep fighting, to running and living to fight another day. So you have places like South Kerry where, you know, the IRA can't win, but it also can't be defeated. So really, it becomes the sort of logic for the movement's leaders about pulling the plug on the campaign, because what you're getting is thousands and thousands and thousands of Republicans are interned across really almost a whole, you know, gulag archipelago of sites, you know, but Tin Town, you know, the internment camps would be the central place. So you have thousands of these soldiers biding their time. And then you've got continuing executions. And then, of course, that entire essentially, you know, climax of atrocities, particularly in County Kerry in March of 1923. So it's really with the collapse of the resistance that I think a lot of Republicans are ready to, you know, pull the plug. But the challenge was many of them who were on the run were in great danger in the summer and even into the fall of 1923. And so that's why I would say when the Civil War ends depends. For those who were interned in the summer of 1923, they were still not being released. Right. And so they begin to protest and had a mass strike in the fall of 1923. And one of the ironies of that strike was that they were striking to be released, and the authorities who were keeping them there were refusing to release them because they were hunger striking. So there was this kind of standoff. So but really what happens is the conflict is ending in a very messy kind of manner by the summer and fall of 1923, but there's still sort of atrocities percolating. For example, it's in the summer of 1923 that Nola Mass goes missing, and it's in the early fall that his body's discovered, you know, in the Wicklow Mountains. And so there's still a lot of reminders of the conflict. And then slowly, in the policy was officially dribs and drabs. The Republican internees were being released. Some were signing out, but there was a lot of peer pressure in the internment camps to not sign out. But if they signed out, they were being let out. Others were just sort of being let out once they quit the hunger strike. And then they are there back in Irish society in late 1923, early 1924, with no jobs, minimal job prospects, because there's an awful lot of official and unofficial blacklisting. One of the things the Free State government did was it encouraged employers to hire Free State Army veterans who were being demobilized, and therefore not to hire Republicans. And many employers were certainly not willing to hire ex-prisoners. So a lot of activists from the IRA and Cumann na mBan were suffering greatly financially. Then there was that specter of political repression, the settling of scores, and so the fear, many people were afraid of a policy that sought to criminally prosecute some of the fighting in the Civil War. Now, that was abandoned eventually, but for a time, that meant that many people who hadn't been captured couldn't really come out in public because they were afraid they would be arrested and charged. So all of these things meant that the Civil War's end was not, you know, wasn't an abrupt, concise moment. It was kind of this kind of messy transition back into civilian life, which was very difficult for a lot of people. And hence, huge numbers of Republicans, thousands from the IRA, immigrated in the 1923, 24, 25, 26, because of lack of job prospects, because of the repression, and because of maybe just a general kind of demoralization.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, because there was no VE Day, so to speak,
or
anything of that nature. And the other thing, of course, is that at the same time, society at large was trying to come to terms with, effectively, it was a new country. This was self-governed, the state, obviously, bar the six counties, and that of itself had a new character to everything. Was there a lot of infrastructural damage, or was there a lot of damage to industry or that during the Civil War that delayed kind of getting off the ground?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the themes that you see during the early Civil War fighting, there are boarded up businesses in Dublin and elsewhere that have signs up that say business as usual, right? And that was kind of an ethos of the Free State, was let's get back to business. People are, in many ways, one of the things that makes the Irish Civil War kind of surreal is that it could be this all-consuming experience for some people who, you know, suffered greatly. But a lot of people were trying as best they could to go about their daily lives. So that wasn't possible in parts of rural Ireland where the bridges had been blown, the roads had been trenched, the mails weren't getting there, old age pensions weren't getting there, food wasn't getting there. Great disruptions. But in parts of Dublin in the spring of 1923, right at that moment when Republicans in Kerry are suffering greatly with these atrocities, the cinemas of Dublin are packed with people. People are regularly going about their lives to movies. The races are happening again. There's a massive heavyweight fight, you know, with the battling Siki and McTeague, you know, in March of 23. And the IRA is really frustrated by this. And so they actually tried to have a ban, kind of enforce a boycott on public amusements. People shouldn't be going out and about enjoying life while they're suffering, you know. That didn't succeed, although they kind of threatened some business owners. But really, I think coming out of the Civil War, you would see incredible damage in Dublin. I mean, they hadn't even recovered from the destruction of 1916. And then you have the heavy fighting around the forecourts in 1922, tons of bridges and infrastructural damage, tens and tens of millions of pounds at the time in damage. So all those costs, and then all the costs of outfitting that army, and then immediately demobilizing that army, which is itself another very kind of socially dislocating phenomenon. And you have all kinds of armed men, both anti-treaty and pro-treaty, who are, you know, some of them are involved in kind of strong arm tactics. Some of them are even linking up and harassing businesses. There's quite a bit of, you know, kind
afters.
Of a, exactly. There's a kind of, well, and you see this across Europe in the post-war period. I mean, what do you do with a lot of people whose trade involved, you know, the use of a gun? These are warriors who now have to go back to civilian society where their sacrifices and their, the skills that they've acquired are no longer useful. And there wasn't a lot of room for them in these, in a military fashion. So I think, a lot of people are eager to get back, to, their lives and their jobs. And this includes the veterans, but you know, the early 20s was a period of economic recession. And so for a lot of them, the answer was immigration. And so there was a sort of artificial break on Irish immigration at the time of the Great War because of the disruption to transatlantic traffic and all that. But by the early 1920s, with massive armies being demobilized, you're starting to get hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people from Ireland are immigrating. The vast majority will go to the United States, even though new quotas, a whole new quota system was created. It was much harder to immigrate. You had to have money, a medical test, references. But hundreds of thousands go there. And then, although it wasn't documented, so we don't have the exact figure, quite a few would go to Britain either permanently or as a stepping stone or to Australia and elsewhere. So all these people are kind of getting out. And I think once again, the case can be made that just as under British rule, immigration was often this kind of social safety valve, right? Like, you know, when land was congested and there wasn't enough land for everybody, vast numbers of people immigrated in the post-famine period from the West, particularly. You see that beginning again in the 1920s, but this time it's inflected by, you know, a kind of political exile where the people who are who fought in the anti-treaty IRA, often from areas that would have had high immigration, that's starting up again, but they've got the added burden of, you know, not being particularly welcomed by employers and the state. And so I think that's what's kind of in the mix. And a lot of other people are scrambling for jobs. Particularly, we often, you know, forget that although the Sinn Féin movement and revolution is associated with lots of high ideals, lots of noble ideals, incredible acts of heroism and sacrifice by ordinary people, there was also an expectation by the end, a not unreasonable expectation by the end of the revolution, you know, like, what do I get out of this?
Yeah.
You know, and some people, maybe less deservedly, got permanent jobs, sinecures, you know, a lot of jobbery, and then others found themselves, you know, penniless. And so that was a source of grievance and friction within Irish society as well, I think.
Yeah, and there's a lot of issues there, I suppose, that came, as you said, that immigration. No, and I'm assuming that the vast majority of those immigrants probably never returned, like immigrants in general.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, well, Ireland is unique in the 19th century, I think. It's one of the few European countries, you know, that was feeding a lot of immigrants to the U.S. that had the lowest rates of repatriation. Very few went back. What I understand of the 1920s outflow, particularly focusing on the anti-treaty IRA who left, most didn't come back. Although a few did, and the things that, you know, immigration historians often talk about, you know, the pushes out of your country and the pulls to a given destination. Well, once they got to the United States, what pushed some back to Ireland was the Great Depression. Okay, there weren't a lot of jobs.
Yes, yes.
But another really important pull back to Ireland was the ascendancy of De Valera's Fianna Fáil. Once his party was a really going concern and he started the Irish press, Fianna Fáil received tons of letters from veterans in the States looking for work, looking for jobs. And a lot of people expected jobs on the Irish press, which did provide quite a bit of employment. And for others, it just seemed like the boat was turning and that their political and personal, situation yeah. might improve once De Valera's crowd was in office. So some came back. But like you say, the vast majority, they stayed in Cleveland and Boston and New York.
And then there was, I suppose, in a lot of different ways, as you said, that sense of disappointment. Like, what was it all about in the end? I think in particular that, if you know John McGahern's great book, Amongst Women and Mourn, the main protagonist had been a veteran, and it was really like, what was it all about in the end? One element to that, and there's been a bit of research done in this, I think Dermot Ferreter did some, but was in relation to the military pensions.
Sure.
They seem to have been very tight
right.
in what
yes.
they gave out in terms of the military
yeah.
pensions.
That was a real key site of sort of conflict, and where you can really kind of see play out those expectations versus the realities, because the realities were that, the Irish Free State had a big bill to pay with damages wrought from the Revolution and Civil War. And, their economic policy in the 20s, their mode was retrenchment, cutting pensions. And, they needed to be very careful with the money. So they tended to be very tight-fisted with the money that was given through the pension system. And then, of course, that pension system in the 20s didn't include service in the anti-treaty IRA. Right. So,
if you were in the anti-treaty IRA, could you claim a pension for the War of Independence?
I don't. That's a good question. I don't believe so. But at the very least, most were not asking for that. What they were waiting for was the extension of pensions to anti-treatyites, which De Valera delivered when he came into office. But here's the funny thing: some activists in the Republican movement didn't simply want De Valera to extend pensions to anti-treatyites. He wanted him to revoke them, which he very smartly did not do, because that probably would have affected the peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah.
But that system, which is very similar to lots of other systems after the First World War, where countries were offering these compensations, like you say, was tightly controlled. They could only give a small amount of money to most people. But some people were in such difficult, or their dependents were in such economic straits in the 20s, that even a small amount of money was the difference between, living, getting by,
yeah.
and slipping into total poverty. Some people simply got a medal. Some people didn't even get that. And some people turned their noses up at the whole system, because either out of a sense of pride or a sense of just, I didn't fight for this, or they just didn't trust the state,
And in terms of communities in that, Gavin, as I said, to some extent it was brother against brother. It was certainly, though they knew each other, the character of that kind of an up-close conflict, as opposed to, look, it's a horrible scenario. People are shooting anybody. But if you're shooting somebody who's wearing a uniform and they're from another country, they're impersonal to you in that instant, what have you, as opposed to that whole nature of brother against brother. Was there a lot of trauma in communities as a result of those, literally, you're talking about less than
sure.
12 months, really?
Sure, yeah. And I think that's such a really crucial issue to consider, is that, the War of Independence and earlier fighting, although it certainly involved members of the same country, the members, the men in the RIC were, they didn't serve locally, of course, but they were native Irishmen who were recruited. And of course, there was some internal and sectarian violence during the War of Independence. Fundamentally, though, that conflict was viewed as, the Irish nation fighting a historical foe, an opponent who had to bring in troops and auxiliaries and mercenaries, right? So there was a sense that you were fighting a foreign opponent. And those wars can be brutal and ugly, but at the end of the day, you don't have to settle down with the black and tan as your next door neighbor. Your enemy will, if they lose the war and don't succeed in invading and pushing you out, they go home, right? But a civil war is a very different kind of conflict, because, unless an entire population is essentially removed from a territory, which happens in some civil wars. But in this case, the people have to live again, except for those that immigrate, but they have to live in the same communities and try to repair the social fabric of those communities. So I think, in fact, we've heard a lot of talks at this conference, and there's a lot of scholarship on this as well. We're getting into more comparative, transnational approaches to the study of the Irish Revolution, globalizing it, so to speak. And often when you compare the Irish Civil War to the Finnish Civil War around the same time, 1918, or many other conflicts, we kind of feel kind of, so it's a bit of a sobering experience to see how much smaller scale the Irish experience was. And yet I would still contend that it's all that much more bitter because it's not a, it wasn't a civil war between two different ethno-religious groups that had centuries of animosity, what you might see in the Balkans or something. It was between people, and to a great extent, who were just part of the same movement. So literally 6 or 12 months before, they were best friends, they were in the flying column, they were in the GAA together, their neighbors knew each other, they went to school together, and now they may find themselves on the opposite sides of the split. I don't see what can be more kind of traumatizing and bittering in terms of a war environment than that. And so it absolutely would impact then those local communities and all those associations and networks and friendships that had to kind of come out of the civil war, and who do you socialize with? Who do you interact with, and how do you maintain a kind of and repair a civil society coming out of that?
Yeah, very difficult. It's a bit, I suppose, it's in a far more benign sense, it's a bit like the most savage GA games can be the neighboring parish rather than the person at the far end of the county, like, you know, that kind of thing. But and that goes into the mix again, along with economic deprivation to a large extent, along with this immigration. Things were pretty grim. It's interesting that, particularly the 20s, you know, you've this image of Clonmacnoise led by W.T. Cosgrave as being dour, I think is the word. But when you look at the conditions that were there, there was an awful lot to be dour about, unfortunately.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah, there's a reputation of the, you know, the early Cosgrave government, even before the Civil War ended, where there's a pretty almost authoritarian kind of cynical view of the Irish people, you know, like O'Higgins, who's infamous for some of his pronouncements, you know, where basically you needed somebody to really kind of grab the people by the collar and slap them around a bit to get, because there was a sense that, and this is one of the challenges of coming out of the revolution, is that for the preceding few years and maybe going back to generations, there was something patriotic about resisting the government when you didn't feel it was your own government. Not paying the rates could be a form of political expression. And then suddenly, December 1922, you have this new crowd in office saying, now you must pay your rates. Now you must obey the law. Now you must respect the Peeler. And that was kind of alien to a lot of people who had you know, either been very politically active or had just sort of like gotten used to the power vacuum. And so in the 20s, there was a huge task, political, social, economic, that, you know, the new Free State government had to deal with. I mean, they had to deal with it both at the elite levels of diplomacy, you know, managing and navigating the Free State's relationship to the other dominions, and pushing the structures of the treatyite settlement in such a way towards greater sovereignty, you know, the stepping stones approach, which they did to a considerable extent, at least symbolically, right? But then on the other hand, they had to deal with the bread and butter of, and sometimes that entailed replacing revolutionary activists with what they saw as more competent administrators. Yes. And that happened all over at many levels. And you can only imagine the you know, the ructions and the animosities that generated. You know, do you give the jobs and the land to IRA veterans, or do you give it to somebody who has, you know, the relevant experience? And so there were lots of tensions there. Wasn't pleasant. It wasn't easy. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, there is some emphasis in the historiography and the scholarship on the Civil War of kind of, you know, recognizing that, well, the Kumanenail establishment in the 20s wasn't exactly anything that one would like sing romantic ballads about, you know.
No.
They had a pretty unpleasant kind of task. And, you know, and to some extent, when Fianna Fáil came into office in 1932, a lot of that work had been done, but they had to do some of that unpleasant stuff of leadership and administration that inevitably lost them some, you know, some followers as well. And a little bit of the patriotic sheen was off them by once you take office, right?
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, the other interesting thing I think about it is, and okay, it does take a bit of time. Fianna Fáil is founded in 1926 and they're in power 6 years later.
Right.
But when you go back to the Civil War, despite what you might think at a cursory level, the Republicans were actually very much in a minority, both militarily and even in terms of support. I mean, the general election in June 22, I think, was, they got about a quarter of the vote, roughly. Yet, within 10 years, De Valera, and I don't know, is it De Valera, has managed to flip that to a point where Fianna Fáil are not just the biggest party, but they managed thereafter to stay in power for 16 years.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Yeah, so that's a really important, first of all, that's an incredible, kind of change up. You know, in a 10-year period, the losers of the Civil War essentially become the winners, you know, politically, of the political stakes. But see, but also to me, it brings into question the value of the 22 and 23 election results as a sort of barometer of public opinion. Because of the 22 election, the PACT election, has all kinds of problems with who was obeying the PACT, who was defying it. The Constitution was published the same day. Some people read it and knew its terms were not going to meet the republicanizing, you know, hopes that Collins had. So, and, you know, and there was some intimidation and stuff. So it's hard to know with that one. The August 23 election is an interesting example, too. It's a good example of this tension between the Civil War not quite being over, but the new government eager to say, look, we've won, it's business as usual. So what you get in August 23 is, on the one hand, you've got a considerable number of IRA fighters are still on the run, afraid they're going to be murdered if they're captured. You've got thousands of IRA internees who are about to embark on a hunger strike because there seems to be no apparent movement towards their release because the government doesn't trust the dump arms order, which still leaves the guns out there, right? They wouldn't surrender the guns. But then on the other hand, you have this election. So how do you have a kind of free exercise in democracy? So what ends up happening is, you know, De Valera is famously arrested at a political rally in Clare. There's various acts of intimidation, some ballot, you know, box stuffing and this kind of stuff. So the results of that election still show a majority, obviously, for the treaty, but it shows a pretty stubborn anti-treaty vote, particularly in the West, you know, which is going to be a really key base for, you know, the Fianna Fáil party. And then I think what happens over the 20s is a couple things. I think the average Joe, you know, a lot of voters and stuff maybe get more and more estranged from the pro-treaty establishment with, you know, its cutting of budgets. And, you know, I write a lot about, you know, the top hats and silk ties and, you know, their kind of appearance on the imperial stage. It doesn't sit right with a lot of people. They're aligned with some of the bigger business interests. So they don't seem to have a great program for workers, for small farmers and the like. So that's ripe for the picking for Fianna Fáil to identify with that and their constituency. But plus, I think you get all of these, there's a considerable number in the 20s, you know, more Sinn Féin purists who don't go over to Fianna Fáil initially because, you know, they don't accept the logic of walking into the Free State Dáil and willing to take the oath or at least to push it aside and say it doesn't matter. So, but eventually over the course of the 20s, they're broke. The organization is, you know, non-functioning. How long can you live as an internal exile in a state? You know, Todd Andrews writes about this sometimes, being with people who didn't lick a stamp, who couldn't get a passport, who couldn't get a job because they wouldn't take the oath. That's some maintained that for years, some for decades. But eventually, when there was some momentum around Fianna Fáil, I think it attracted more of them to say, you know, maybe we can really redo the state from within. And they kind of went his way. So I think there was a kind of movement into Fianna Fáil that might not necessarily have been there right away.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
And then as you move on to the 20s and it appears things are settling down, and 1927, you have the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins. Did that kind of come out of the blue?
Yeah, that's a fascinating event and, you know, a tragedy that I think shocked a lot of people, right? I mean, they say that the day it happened, the Free State Cabinet hadn't, you know, could only assume this might be the beginning of some kind of coup d'etat, right? So they went into hiding, you know, briefly because they didn't know it was a one-off event. There was a fear this was because there were, you know, works, there were discussions in the IRA, which was at a pretty low ebb, but they were, you know, recruiting new members. They were, you know, gathering guns, and they were aware of intelligence gathering on them. And so, and a few civic guards were killed in the 20s too, and lots of public safety legislation was in place. So it was still a very tense time. So his death, though, I think, kind of, well, it did one immediate result is it removed the abstentionist option for De Valera, because a law was passed that said if you have to not merely, you won't be able to practice abstentionism because you're going to have to sign a document when you sign up as a candidate,
right.
I believe how it was. I don't know why the British didn't do that before in 1917 and 18, but basically, so as a result, if you were going to run, you couldn't just run symbolically. You had to say that you would take your seat. So with that, and I think that actually played right into De Valera's strategy, because I think he was eager to you know, get out of the wilderness, you know, to use the cliche. So I think it was sobering in the sense that De Valera had to kind of distinguish himself in the Fianna Fáil group, had to kind of distinguish themselves from this kind of revolutionary violence. They didn't feel the time was right for it. Shocked a lot of people. But I think it was like a, I think it's well established. It was pretty much a one-off event. It wasn't a sanctioned hit. I think it was a crime of opportunity, but rooted in a great sense that fairly or not, and it's probably a bit unfairly, you know, O'Higgins was perceived as the hard man of the cabinet. Yeah. Because, you know, what it was not so much that he internally was the one pushing the hardest decisions. In fact, he arguably, it's been said, he came late to the room.
Going back to the Civil War itself. Yeah,
if you go back to the Civil War itself, it said that O'Higgins came late to the room when they were debating about a reprisal execution following the shooting of Sean Hales and Porrigo Malia, right? So he agreed to it because the cabinet always voted in... basically reported all of its decisions as a unanimous thing. But once they made these decisions, O'Higgins was willing to rhetorically champion the decision. So he famously said, you know, we executed 77 anti-treaty soldiers in order to defend the free state and the will of the people. We'll execute 777 more, which made him seem like a particularly staunch supporter of this. But I think he was more making the principled argument that the government has a monopoly on the means of violence. And if it's a democratically, popularly elected government, it has the right to do this. But so for whatever reasons, he was particularly an object of hatred amongst a lot of anti-treaty veterans. So yeah, they topped him, so to speak, you know, in 1927. And that set into motion then Fianna Fáil going into the Dáil. And then that, you know, in that sense, the positive outcome of that, at least, was that it kind of brought Civil War politics increasingly away from, you know, the use of a gun into, all right, we're now going to deal with this at the parliamentary level. And that's often the best way in that, you know, these kind of Civil War politics. You know, Civil War politics is often seen as a bad thing, you know, as it's this kind of sclerotic system where the two sides didn't have much apart, you know, many coherent policy differences. But, you know, other than their old hatreds. But in fact, it also meant that the losing side could find a way back into the system, change it from within in a healthy democratic manner, which created stability in the Southern Irish state for the next decades.
Were there reports that when Fianna Fáil did go into the Dáil for the first time, that things were so tense that some of them were carrying guns?
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that in their trench coats, they were afraid that there would be resistance to their entry, because I think as we do know, of course, soon after Fianna Fáil went into office, you have the emergence of a, you know, series of organizations that, you know, we know as the Blue Shirts, right? That there was a real concern amongst the military establishment, which was the pro-treaty establishment, that their anti-treaty foes were going to really turn the tables on them. But I think it was wise that De Valera didn't retract or revoke their pensions, because that would have been a serious, antagonism. He didn't do that. I think my understanding is the one key person who was kicked out of office, and there was a fear that he was going to kick everybody out of office and put in his people. He also avoided that level of kind of naked patronage. But the one person that was kicked out was Owen O'Duffy.
Oh, yeah.
But my understanding is he was offered another position, which he didn't accept. And he also had the extraordinary experience of, you know, having been the police commissioner for a decade, during which, you know, he had amassed a lot of power and had done a lot of spying on enemies and kept a lot of files to himself. My understanding is that he would have been a very difficult person to stay in that position after 32. And of course, his subsequent checkered career suggests that he wasn't the great paragon of legal law and order, you know, that you
absolutely,
would need.
Absolutely, you know. And the bitterness that would have been there, Gavin, the you know, it's just so difficult to escape. That infected politics for a long time afterwards.
I think so. I mean, on the one hand, it gets institutionalized between the two parties, right?
Yeah.
And my sense, at least in the 1920s, but I think it's there in the early 1930s, is that although Fianna Fáil, yes, is a political party, and now it's the establishment, there's a sense that they're still a movement. They're a cause. You know, because they say during the revolution into the Civil War that, you know, Republicans didn't like the term politicians, that was a dirty word, Todd Andrews says, you know. But of course, they're politicians in the state in the 1930s, but they still have this slightly revolutionary air.
Not a brilliant move by Dev. We're a movement, not a party.
Yeah, exactly.
Creating these images.
Like, yeah, they're above party politics.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and so they made those reforms, you know, of the treaty, of, you know, got rid of all the clauses and got the treaty ports back. And but the 30s are a very turbulent period. And you know, between the economic war and the anger of a lot of the, you know, the farmers who relied on, you know, exporting cattle and the collapse of that whole, you know, there are a lot of economic tensions and then all these fascinating ideological kind of currents that, you know, are distinct from the Civil War, but overlap with it, you know, whether or not to support, you know, to get involved in the Spanish Civil War and, you know, pro-Franco and then socialist factions and then all the roiling debates in the IRA between the militarists and the, you know, Republican Congress and all that. And then meanwhile, Fianna Fáil is supposed to represent the Republican movement, but is increasingly losing, you know, respect of those more hardliners.
And by 1940, under Dev's government, they actually executed IRA men.
Yeah, so when you talk about bitterness, there's absolutely the bitterness between pro and anti-treatyites. And we see that in the street fights with the blue shirts, right, and the IRA. But then there's great bitterness between factions of the Republican movement that don't support Fianna Fáil or withdraw their support by the time that he's passing or re-engaging some of the public safety legislation that the Cumann na n-Éill or Fine Gael, you know, now Fine Gael government will and would use, you know, internment, executions, and also a very hard line against hunger strikers. In some ways, you can make the case that some of the most effective enforcers against the IRA and Republican tactics are people who had employed those tactics before, you know. And so, the hunger strike deaths and the executions in the 1940s were deeply embittering. And when I was doing my interviews, oral history interviews around Civil War memory a couple of years ago, I mean, in places like, you know, Kerry, there was, you know, you could kind of get a sense of which animosities that would have been directed against, you know, Collins and O'Higgins and Mulcahy during the Civil War can get projected on to De Valera by the 1940s because of what he did, you know. And then so, and the execution victims, whether they're executed in Mountjoy by the British or executed, you know, in custom barracks by, you know, McKeown and the Free State government, or by De Valera in the 1940s, that's all still part of a continuity for the Republican movement. So that's a new form of bitterness. And so there's a lot of unfinished business, you might say, about the revolution, you know.
And then, Gavin, finally, the it lasted, I suppose, when you think of the impact of that, it lasted, okay, we're talking realistically, you're talking June 22 until, you know, as you very well described the way it petered out, but you could be talking summer, just after summer, maybe 23, a year, effectively. And when you look at the bitterness, the fallout, I wonder the institutionalizing of it in the political parties. Did that make it longer, perpetuate it?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the questions. I mean, there's been some interesting debate and discussion recently about, you know, reconciliation and what were the means of reconciliation, what could have reconciled, and why wasn't there some reconciliation? And so, yeah, I think, you know, what are the forces that are perpetuating it versus the forces that are seeking to sort of repress or maybe reconcile the Civil War memory? And I think I think the party political system by the 1930s with the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil divide arguably does perpetuate it. It makes it a nonviolent conflict, which is the positive, but it means that the two sides are basically run by partisans in the Civil War, you know, who are both, you know, kind of contesting custodianship of not just of putting aside the Civil War, of just the earlier revolution, right? So it makes it hard for them to come together and say, mutually commemorate 1916 and mutually commemorate the founding of the volunteers and things that they did when Sinn Féin was unified and had momentum. They couldn't go back and do those things together because they were contesting who had the right. You know, was it Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or the IR or, you know, new, more Republican iterations? So it does get perpetuated, and there's a couple reasons for that. Besides that, maybe it's the fact that so many of these figures from the Civil War were in office and in public life for so long. I mean, De Valera was super slow to let go of power, and even when he stepped down from, you know, being Taoiseach and leader of Fianna Fáil, he's a president till the 70s, you know. There's a sense in which his presence in public life just meant the Civil War was kind of always there. And while quite a few revolutionaries died quite, you know, prematurely, no doubt connected to their, you know, the privations and hardships of the revolution, so many lived in the 50s and 60s, even to the 70s, and probably had an outsized impact, you could say, on the sort of political and social culture.
The mass was Taoiseach until... was it 66?
Right, and of course he was actively involved in the Civil War, and of course his brother was infamously murdered in the wake.
I also got the impression, though, he was somebody who, very much unlike others perhaps, was willing to forgive and forget to some extent the mass. You got that impression?
Yeah, my understanding was that he was very reticent about some of these issues, because they say in the, and I've seen some examples of this, I know that, you know, in the 1940s and 50s, even sometimes dull debates would, you know, all of a sudden turn into some kind of a shouting match, and insults would be traded, and then all of a sudden the Civil War would be, you know, present in the room. But I think really often it was, there's a sense of an absence, right? The one of the great legacies, I actually think there's sort of two key legacies of the Civil War when we look at sort of memory issues, and it's kind of a paradox. On the one hand, there's this idea that all these silences were sown, that you know, Dorothy McCardle in 1924 in The Tragedies of Kerry, the little pamphlet, you know, said that there's a wall of silence around, you know, the some of these atrocities in Kerry. Not that it's forgotten, but people aren't publicly discussing it. But of course, she said this in 24 when it was still very dangerous for Republican activists. But then decades later, another writer in Kerry, you know, refers to a conspiracy of silence as well. So there's this sense of silence, of reticence, of not discussing it outright because it's so divisive, you know. Whatever you say nothing, might have been like the kind of ethos at the time, easier to talk about the weather with your neighbor than to remember the most embittering experiences of the community, you know.
But even if you internalize it like that, for the times, was there any other way of dealing with it?
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, we live in a culture now where there's, it seems to me, there's so much... you know, processing of trauma, and there's a lot of, frankly, you know, power that comes with, you know, claims of victimization, and that's one of those are some of the influences on our society's, you know, obsession with memory, right? It's connected to victim claims, it's connected to trauma, and that's all very important. But I think we also forget sometimes, and with older generations as well, there can be a value to reticence and silence. And I think too, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons for this, but it also comes down to the fact that, you know, we don't have veterans right now to talk to, right? That generation is gone. But when I talk to their descendants, their children, and the next generation after, with growing up, they very often say, "Well, I didn't hear much about the Civil War from my parents." Rarely, there might be a family where it was discussed obsessively, but generally not mentioned very much. And you know, that might remind us then about the trauma and the bitterness of the Civil War. But it's also, you know, if you imagine a parent in the 30s. You know, were they really going to, or the 40s, were they really going to talk to their children about the most trying time of their lives? I mean, you hear stories about, you know, World War II vets in the U.S., you know, who came home after experiencing incredible, you know, horrible experiences in, say, fighting in the Pacific. They didn't go home and talk about it with their children or even their wives, you know? So it's not that surprising that it wasn't spoken about that much. And, you know, in some of the interviews I've done, when you look in local communities, right, it's one thing to stand on a stage and to give a speech in the head of an election. And, you know, the heat is on and there's a, you know, the blood is up and there's a lot of, you know, recriminations. That might be a time when it's discussed and it would be discussed. But, you know, everyday life when, you know, people live in a small community or going into the shops or farmers are having to interact and I think in those environments, not talking about it was a way of functioning and a way of reestablishing civility. Doesn't mean people forgot, and there might be whispers and finger pointing and stories, and certain person might. I mean, I've heard stories of somebody avoiding a given route their whole lives because they wanted to avoid a neighbor and other, you know, and avoiding a shop because of, you know, the tensions there. But that doesn't mean it wasn't always bursting out into the surface, because how could everyday life go on if that was the case of it, you know?
Finally, Gavin, and you mentioned Finland, which was pretty vicious, and you had the likes in the 30s of Spain, and there was other various conflicts. By those standards, in terms of the aftermath, that business of memory, of trauma or whatever, how did Ireland fare, in your opinion, in that respect? Do you know what I mean? Was the trauma outsized compared to the actual event that lasted for 12 months?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would contend, I think, you know, that the shadow of the Civil War in some ways eclipses the event itself, you know? Like you say, it was a relatively short event in terms of really serious fighting began in June of 22, peters out in the summer of 23. They used to believe that there were thousands and thousands of deaths in the Civil War. You know, older books will tell you 8,000, 5,000. Now we've brought that down to maybe 1,500, maybe 1,200. So relatively small. But I think as we were kind of saying earlier, you know, it's this idea, it's the symbolism of the event. It's one thing to fight a foreign soldier. You know, there's a narrative, there's a history, there's a mythology, there's a meaning to that people can make. It's another thing, though, to have the nascent Irish state execute 77 people. It's another thing to have Michael Collins, you know, the pride of the country, the pride of Cork as well, but, you know, the pride of the country, this great figure, you know, killed in an ambush in such a, you know, such a lurid fashion, you know, by the very people that, you know, he would have was conspiring with, you know, just a few months before and was in service with. So, I mean, I think all of those things were really shocking. And I think if you also go back to the earlier rhetoric of the revolution, a lot of it, and I think this was necessary to make a country that had been colonized feel like they could take on the greatest imperial power, they had an outsized sense of moral superiority, that Ireland was blessed, that Ireland had like a destiny for the world to be this great spiritual country, you know, against the materialism and the griminess and the criminality of Britain. That was a big part of it. You know, we were clean living, you know, cream of the crop, fighting against these, you know, the dregs of British prisons. This was like a rhetoric, you know, and I think the Civil War shocked a lot of people. Wait, you know, the same people who we could morally justify carrying out assassinations in 1920 are now, you know, taking, you know, boys who are distributing anti-treaty pamphlets, and they're taking them out to you know, Clondalkin and murdering them. Like, this really shocked a lot of people, and so I think that sense of shock, you know, gave it an outsized, gave the event this kind of outsized legacy where it was hard to forget and hard to remember the earlier moments of the revolution that showed more common sacrifice and that were more elevated and noble, I think. So it really is the conflict itself is deeply unfortunate and tragic, but it also really kind of puts the entire revolution in this uncomfortable light, which is why when in the 30s and 40s and 50s, when veterans and, you know, we're historicizing and memorializing the Civil War, which is why so many of those accounts, you know, the Cork's fighting story and Kerry's fighting story, the Bureau of Military History Project, and countless memoirs, you know, from Tom Barry and others, why they end in 1921.
Yeah.
It's a clean break. That's the fight, you know, that we should have been fighting. And that's why we remember that. Whereas what happens after 1921, the factionalism, the finger pointing, the enmity, the violence is so much harder to understand, I think, as a community. But now, of course, like with events like what are happening here in this, you know, the 100th anniversary of the start of the Civil War, you know, we're realizing the extent to which the memory didn't evaporate, and, you know, families and communities, you know, really held on to a lot of these stories and an understanding and awareness of the conflict. Now we're trying to bring that back out, I think, into public history and into the scholarship.
Gavin, thank you very much for some fascinating insights.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
That's it for this episode in our Civil War series, folks. I'd like to thank, as always, our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.